Adventure of the Scrap of Paper, George Barton. Bromley Barnes and Admiral Hawksby sat on either side of a flat-topped desk in the Navy Department, talking in low, earnest tones. The grizzled face of the old sea fighter looked sterner than usual, while the attentive, earnest countenance of the veteran investigator indicated that he fully appreciated the importance of the communication which was being made to him. The purport of it was simple enough, and sufficiently alarming to call for prompt action. The secrets of the department were being peddled to the enemy. Orders that were presumably known to only three persons in Washington were finding their way to hostile quarters with a rapidity and a certainty that was almost uncanny.
"We've got to locate the leak, Barnes," said the admiral, emphasizing the remark with a resounding blow on the desk with his closed fist, "or I'll feel like handing in my resignation."
An incredulous laugh came from the bald-headed man with the fringe of iron-gray hair which encircled his head with a halo-like effect.
"Resign," he retorted. "That sounds like retreat, and I didn't think that word had any place in the vocabulary of a man who ran the blockade."
"Never mind that,"
hastily interrupted Hawksby, who feared the usual eulogy for the gallant action which had won him a gold medal and the thanks of Congress.
"You know what I mean. I feel so impotent in this underhand business that I scarcely know what to do. If it was an out-and-out face-to-face fight, I'd know just how to act. I'm depending on you to get to the bottom of the thing. Will you help me?"
"Yes," was the prompt reply. "But you've got to help me first. Now, you say the last message that was intercepted related to the movements of the Asiatic fleet. Please let me see a copy of the order."
The admiral pressed a button on the desk, and in a few moments a young man with coal-black hair and brown skin entered the room.
"Lee," said the sailor, "get me the order book. I think you will find it in the copying press."
As the admiral sat stroking his mustache and imperial, Barnes looked at him curiously.
"Who is that man?" he asked.
"That chap? Oh, that's a West Indian who acts as a sort of personal servant to me."
"Do you mean to say that he has access to the copybook and is given the run of the place?"
Hawksby drew himself up stiffly.
"I don't know what you mean by the run of the place, and besides, the orders are in code and would be Greek to him or any other man except to myself and the Secretary of the Navy."
Presently the messenger returned, and for the next 10 minutes the two men were deeply engrossed in the intricacies of the naval code and the details of how the orders had been transmitted. Barnes asked 101 questions and finally departed with the intimation that he might return and ask some more before he started in on his difficult task.
"It all depends upon circumstances," he said, "and in the meantime I'm going to take a long walk to get the cobwebs out of my head."
He went to his apartments near the Capitol first and gave some general orders to his assistant and general factotum. He consulted a number of maps, and then he started out on one of the long strolls which had made him as familiar with the streets of the national capital as the famous caliph was with the equally celebrated city of Baghdad. No member of the cabinet, and not one of the foreign diplomats at Washington, could have been more fastidious in his dress than this investigator who had come from his retirement to assist his government during a critical stage in its history. The frock coat, the carefully creased trousers, the gray spats, the opal in his green tie, and the tightly rolled silk umbrella which took the place of a walking stick were all just as they should be, or at least just as Barnes felt they should be. He walked up one street and down the other, thinking all the while of the problem that had been given into his care. A stranger, noting the cold gray eyes and the quizzical smile, would have thought him a man without a care in the world. He must have been walking for an hour when his steps led him into that section of the city known as Farragut Circle. He noticed, in a casual way, that an automobile was standing in front of one of the houses. And then an incident, seemingly insignificant in itself, roused all of his thinking faculties. The driver of the car had taken the cover from a sandwich. Instead of tossing it aside, he carefully rolled the oiled paper into a little ball and threw it on the sidewalk. At the same moment, a nattily dressed man with a waxed mustache and a pink carnation in the buttonhole of his stylish coat came down the steps of the house and picked up the discarded bit of paper. He looked up and down the street in a nervous manner, as if to make sure that he was not observed, and then, turning briskly, re-entered the house. The incident did not take a minute, but to the watching Barnes it was like a drama itself. Instantly, the driver of the car put his foot on the lever of the machine and it whizzed away. But in that brief time, the detective had obtained the number of the machine and a mental picture of the chauffeur. He noted the number and location of the house, and then, with his quizzical smile broadening, hastened to his own apartment. On the morning after the incident of the oiled paper, a new janitor appeared at the apartment house on Farragut Circle. He wore a blouse and overalls and seemed to fit into the scheme of the place much better than the house itself did with the richer and more pretentious dwellings with which it was surrounded. The new tyrant of the place was most industrious and showed a desire to please that was truly amazing upon the part of a modern janitor. His round face and bald head were smudged with soot and dirt, and his features were all but recognizable. But even the evidence of praiseworthy toil could not change the cold, gray eyes and the quizzical smile which were a part of the personality of Bromley Barnes. He made friends with everybody, especially the women and children, and he had the run of the house, which was to be expected in one who was presumably charged with its destinies. In 24 hours the new janitor was familiar with the place and its occupants. No matter how unkempt he might seem himself, he showed a real desire to keep the house tidy. Residents were delighted to find a man who was willing to carry off the contents of their waste paper baskets and trash cans, and they were united in designating him as a jewel of a janitor. On the evening of the second day, the new man sat in his quarters in the basement of the house, smoking a corncob pipe and looking the picture of contentment. But later that night, when most of the guests were sleeping the sleep of the just, the janitor had pulled down the blinds of his own modest apartment and was relentlessly pawing over scraps of paper that had been found in the waste baskets. For more than an hour he worked there with a patience and a persistence beyond all praise. At the end of that time he began to show signs of weariness, but just when he seemed ready to quit, he gave a cry of delight. He had found a little scrap of oiled paper, twisted and rolled into a tiny ball. Slowly and carefully, he unrolled it and spread it out on the little wooden table. It contained several typewritten lines which the old man found some difficulty in deciphering. But the hardest task has its end, and finally he was able to read these significant words. "Gunboats, Philadelphia and Newark, have been ordered to join the Asiatic fleet. 200 Jackies have been assigned to special duty in this connection. Ammunition in large quantities to be shipped. More details in the next 24 hours. Bromley Barnes gave a sigh of relief. He picked up the little scrap of paper reverently and placed it in his wallet. Then, with that quizzical smile hovering about his lips, he undressed and went to bed to enjoy a well-earned night's rest. Things in the apartment house moved along in their accustomed grooves for some days. The man with the waxed mustache and pink carnation did not appear to have any occupation, yet for a man without regular employment he seemed to be amazingly busy. Percival Roberts, for by that name he was addressed, had a room near the top of the house, an attic room that by no means corresponded with his careful dress and fastidious manners. He suggested a person who spends much time at the barber's, and regarded the manicuring of his nails as a sort of religious rite. Such a one was not likely to bestow much attention on a mere janitor, and when the bald-headed man with the cold gray eyes and the quizzical smile passed him on the stairs, Roberts did not even deign to throw a glance in his direction. There were many things that the wax-mustached person was not, but there was one thing he was, or thought he was, and that was a lady-killer. One morning he was coming out of the house when he passed a young woman with a singularly attractive face. She had taken an apartment on the third floor back, and Mr. Percival Roberts made it his business to find out all about her. Gossip flows quite as freely in the modern apartment house as it formerly did in the less pretentious boarding house, and by putting this and that together the young man learned a number of things. First, she was Miss Marie Johnson, and she had come from the far west for the purpose of attending an art school in Washington. Secondly, she had been quite as much taken with Mr. Percival Roberts as he had been with her. That was a hopeful beginning, and before long he had managed to make her acquaintance, and even offered to escort her to the institution where she proposed to take up the study of art. But she smilingly declined this on the ground that it was not wise to mix business with pleasure. In less than a week, however, the acquaintance had prospered to such an extent that Miss Johnson accepted an invitation to accompany Mr. Roberts to the theater, and after that he pressed his suit with much ardor. She did not precisely repulse him, but she tried to make him understand that she had a serious purpose in life, and that she did not propose to be diverted from the plan which had brought her to the national capital. She let him know that she admired men with a purpose in life, and gently intimated that his indolent existence did not promise well for the woman who would consent to be his wife. The bald-headed man with the fringe of gray hair and the cold eyes and the quizzical smile noticed the growing intimacy between the pair, and he merely shrugged his shoulders as much as to say that in the matter of love he could not be regarded as a competent authority. But Percival Roberts felt that when it came to the tender passion he was in his element, and he plainly was flattered at the evident impression he had made upon the studious young woman. It was on the evening of the fifth day that Percival found himself in the cozy sitting-room of Marie Johnson, making his first formal call. He found it very pleasant there. The apartment, furnished with exquisite taste, made an appropriate setting for the girl. She was not beautiful in the usually accepted sense of that much-abused word, but she was undeniably fascinating. He took in every detail of the picture, and it satisfied him. Her coal-black hair parted in the middle and glowing with life and vitality, her dark gray eyes full of spirit and intelligence, and the masterful manner, always feminine, in which she carried herself, convinced Percival that here at last was the one girl in the world for him. They talked of indifferent topics for some time, and finally the young man, taking her shapely hand in his, began to declare his passion. She did not withdraw her hand, neither did she show any inclination to encourage his words. There was just the right degree of modesty mixed with friendliness.
"My dear," he began, "you have my happiness in your keeping. Marie, I want to ask."
But at this point there was a terrific hooting of an automobile horn just outside the apartment house. To the surprise of Marie, the ardent wooer dropped her hand and, rising, walked over to the window. One look was sufficient, for turning to her, he exclaimed,
"Pardon me, I'll be back in a moment."
Before Marie realized what was going on, he had grabbed his hat and hurried from the room. She did not betray any emotion, disappointment or otherwise, but she evidently possessed the curiosity of her sex because she went to the window and, raising the sash, looked below. It was worthwhile, for a curious performance was being enacted. An automobile had halted in front of the house. The driver had just finished taking the covering from a sandwich. Instead of tossing the oiled paper to one side, he rolled it into a small ball and then threw it, with great deliberation, over on the sidewalk. At the same moment, Mr. Percival Roberts, descending the steps of the house, reached over and picked up the discarded paper. The automobile, with a farewell honk-honk, dashed away, while Roberts, with simulated indifference, re-entered the house. Marie closed the window and sat down and awaited the return of the young man. 5 minutes, and then 10, passed, and still he did not come back. Presently, with a look of determination on her face, she left the room and ascended the staircase in the direction of his apartment. It did not take long to reach the entrance to his attic room. The door, fortunately, was slightly ajar, and without the slightest compunction, Marie pushed it open and entered. Roberts was not there. The room was empty. She glanced about hastily and noted the bareness of its furnishings. There was a small cot in the corner of the attic, but it seemed out of place because the room was fitted up more like an office than a place of habitation. A roll-top desk was fitted against the wall, and it was open, showing a mass of papers in much confusion as though the owner had left in a hurry. What did it all mean? Where had Percival Roberts gone? What was his occupation, and what was the meaning of his sudden agitation? Presently, Marie noticed a light screen that shut off one corner of the attic. She had gone too far to retreat, and walking over, she moved the obstruction. She gave a gasp because she saw a revealed flight of steps leading to a trap door that looked out on the roof. Slowly and cautiously, she began to climb the ladder and continued until her head emerged into the outside air. Zip, zip, zip came from nearby, followed by a spluttering sound. She looked in that direction and saw Roberts, his face white and concentrated, working at an instrument. Like a flash, the truth dawned on her. It was a wireless telegraph outfit, and he was the operator. Summoning all her strength, she climbed onto the roof and stood there, supporting herself by holding on to the edge of the trap door. At that moment, he looked up and saw her standing there like an accusing spirit. His face went white, and his voice trembled.
"What are you doing here?"
The color had vanished from her countenance, too, and her eyes danced with excitement. Nevertheless, she managed to speak composedly.
"That is the very question I was going to ask you. What are you doing up here like a thief in the night?"
He had evidently finished with his telegraph because he threw a cover over the outfit and advanced toward her in a threatening way. Her words had cut him like a whip, and he approached her shakily. Bewildered rage and childish fright seemed to be struggling for the mastery. He grabbed her by the wrist, and when he spoke again, it was in a thick, husky voice.
"What do you mean by spying on me? What do you mean by creeping up that ladder? What are you doing here, anyhow?"
She gave a long, drawn breath before she replied. Her hand, holding the edge of the trap door, trembled in spite of her effort to be composed. But presently she spoke in a voice that had a note of pathos in it.
Don't you think that you are the one to explain? You leave me without a word of warning, and when I come to find you, I find you on the roof, acting like a criminal."
He pulled himself together. The look of half-dazed fury left his face. He loosened his hold on her wrist and spoke in low, tender tones.
"Forgive me, Marie. I lost control of myself. You scared me for a moment. I'm sorry. Say that you'll forgive me for my nasty outbreak."
She looked up at him with humid eyes. She seemed to be seeing him through a mist. But this passed quickly, and she said,
"That's very well, but it doesn't explain anything."
He placed his arm about her waist and began to assist her gently down the rude ladder. He closed the trap door, and presently they stood facing one another in the attic room. The seconds seemed like minutes, and when he spoke it was in a slow voice, as though the words were being dragged from his reluctant lips.
"Marie, I'm going to tell you what I would not tell another living soul, but you are entitled to know it. You have often asked me to tell you my occupation. You wondered what I did for a living. I'll tell you. I'm engaged in secret service work."
He had locked the door before he began to speak, and she stood there now with her delicate fingers nervously handling the knob. She seemed to be quivering with terror. Then she raised a white hand and pointed it at him in a shaky manner.
You mean to say that you were a spy?"
His face reddened. That look of bewildered rage returned for a second, and then he said doggedly,
"You can put it that way if you want to do so."
She stood for a moment, swaying with fright. Her voice was very low, and it quivered.
"And in the face of this, you have dared to make love to me. You pretended to care for me."
He rushed over to where she stood and threw his arms about her in frantic fashion.
"Oh, Marie, can't you see that I have been doing it for you? Can't you see that I have been trying to earn the reward that will make us independent? I care for you more than anything in the world. If you care for me, nothing else matters. Say that I am forgiven. Say that you will be my wife."
Her face hardened at that, and she spoke with determination, with that air of decisiveness which he had admired in her so much.
"If you care for me as much as you say, you will tell me everything. Tell me the truth. You must keep nothing from me. You were working against the United States, against your own country. Isn't that a fact?"
"Don't put it that way. I'll tell you everything. I have been representing another nation. You speak of my country. What does that mean? I owe nothing to the country. It has not even given me the chance of making a decent living. And patriotism,
What is that?
Merely a word. The work I have been doing will give me the means to keep you in comfort. We can go away and live in comfort for the rest of our lives.
But a traitor, she murmured. To be married to a traitor?
Please don't talk like that, he implored. And think only that I am doing it for you. The thing we do for love cannot be wrong, and, Marie, I love you so much.
She melted at that and looked at him in a way that seemed to say that she might forgive the offense for the sake of love. He grasped at this opportunity as a drowning man grasps at a straw. He led her to a chair and then began to fumble among the papers on his desk. Presently he secured a number of them in a package, and he waved them in front of her dark gray eyes.
Look, he exclaimed. These few pieces of paper carry with them the power to give us wealth and happiness for the rest of our lives. Promise me that you will say nothing of what you have seen. In a few days all will be well, and then we may go away and be happy with each other. You want to be happy, don't you?
Yes, she said softly. I want to be happy.
Ah! He shouted gaily. I was sure that you were a sensible woman. I realized that from the start.
She looked very tired standing there. There were dark circles under her lustrous eyes, and her chin seemed to quiver from weariness and excitement. She looked at him appealingly.
Now,
she said in a half whisper,
if you will unlock the door, I will go to my own room. I need rest.
He moved as if to comply with her request, but at that instant there came a sharp, peremptory knock on the panel of the door. He opened it quickly, and a smallish man with coal-black hair and brown skin confronted him. The visitor was agitated, and he spoke hurriedly.
We have been discovered. They know about the wireless. The police are likely to be here at any moment. Get away.
As he uttered the last word, the black-haired, brown-skinned man turned and ran down the stairway. Marie had heard all, and she looked the picture of fright and terror. Robert's eyes had narrowed as he received the message, but when he noted the fear in her eyes, he put his arms around her in a comforting way.
It's all right, little girl. We have reached the end of the chapter, but we won't go away empty-handed.
He hastened to the desk and picked up a small packet of papers. He fondled them as one might a favorite child. He looked up with cupidity and triumph in his face.
They've discovered the wireless, but it's too late to prevent the damage. I've got enough here to shake the whole Department of State, not to speak of the Navy. And there's a fortune in it for us. And don't be frightened. I'll take care of you.
He moved toward her, and with a smothered cry she clung to his shoulders. He saw that she was white about the lips, and he could feel that she was trembling. As they stood thus, a gust of wind swept beneath the closed door and rustled a bit of paper on the floor. She gave a cry of terror, and he let out an oath.
I'm like a skittish horse, he said, half apologetically. But it will all be all right. We'll have to make a quick getaway. I'll call a taxi cab and we'll shoot off to the Union Station.
He looked at his watch.
We've just got time to catch the southern train. Before they know it, we'll be at El Paso, and then, once across the border and on Mexican soil, I'll defy the whole bunch to get me.
He was tossing articles of clothing into a grip by this time, and then he paused for a moment to say to Marie,
You'd better go to your room and get a few things together. We'll only have a few minutes. Hurry. I'll have the cab by the time you're ready.
The girl seemed to be more composed by this time. She looked at him with a glance of endearment.
Percival,
she said softly, and the first mention of his given name from her lips thrilled him.
I'll try to be useful. I'll call the cab.
He was delighted beyond measure by her acceptance of the situation. He stooped down and kissed her on the lips. That one act seemed to change the whole character of the enterprise. Instead of a fugitive from justice, he felt like a man about to enter on his honeymoon.
Do so, he murmured in return, and by the time it is here I will be all ready for you.
During the next few minutes there were scenes of feverish activity in that apartment house on Farragut Circle. Percival Roberts lived in a heaven of his own creating. He pictured himself and his beloved in a faraway land, enjoying the fruits of his hard work. but in the midst of his daydreaming, he roused himself to the actualities. If the police were on the way, he did not have much time to spare. He finished his preparations in record time and started downstairs to meet Marie. To his satisfaction, the door of her room was open and he saw her standing there, attired for a journey, and looking as neat and as pretty as anything he had seen in a long while. He gave a sigh of joy. His cup of happiness was full indeed. She was fastening her gloves as he entered the room, and she gave him a smile that thrilled him. Quite evidently, her scruples had vanished, and she was going to imitate him by making the most of her life. He felt flattered, and as he tried to put his thought into words, she interrupted him to say prettily, with just a shade of deference,
"Percival, the cab is at the door now, and we'd better not lose any time."
"Very well, my dear," he replied. "We'll make tracks."
But in spite of his hurry, he paused to admire her costume. She was dressed like a bride, that is to say, in the traveling costume usually affected by the newly wedded. And added to this was a stylish coat that came almost to her shoe tops. As he gazed at this garment, it seemed to give him an inspiration.
"Marie," he said, "you have a pocket on the inside of that coat?"
She had, and she displayed it with the pride with which members of the gentler sex usually exhibit their articles of clothing. Percival looked the satisfaction he felt. He drew the package of papers from his own pocket and handed them to her.
"I want you to put them in your inside pocket," he suggested, "and then I'll know they are in no danger of being lost."
She complied with his request, smilingly, and as she buttoned her coat carefully, he surveyed her for the fifth time with intense pride and an undisguised sense of ownership.
"Before you took those papers," he cried banteringly, "I thought you were the loveliest girl in the world. Now you're that and more. You are the most valuable. You're worth your weight in gold. Those papers are worth millions to the enemy, and they mean wealth and comfort for us. I'm sure you'll guard them, especially if anything should happen to me."
She gently boxed his ears.
"Don't talk like a pessimist," she cried. "It's not a bit like you, and besides, there's a machine out there tooting away for dear life."
2 minutes later, they were seated in the taxicab, to the relief of the driver, who grumbled something about having to wait all day for people who didn't know the value of time. That seemed to amuse Percival, who grimaced at the fellow behind his back and whispered to Marie that time at this moment was the most important thing in his life. He looked at his watch and said to the girl,
"We've got 20 minutes, and I think it would be wise to make a circuit instead of going directly to the station. Then, if by chance we should be followed, we can throw them off the scent."
She laughed gaily.
"You're the most cautious man I ever met. They'll never catch you napping. But do just as you please, my dear."
Accordingly, he gave direction to the green-goggled chauffeur, who resolutely kept his back to his passengers as if still resenting the indignity of having to wait. But he nodded that he understood his orders, especially the one which directed him to let his two passengers off about a square from the Union Station.
"That may keep them from knowing that we actually went to the station," he whispered with a sagacious look at the girl.
The drive took them beyond the White House and then past the Army and Navy Building and the Treasury Department. The driver kept mumbling to himself as though he were questioning the sanity of anyone driving about the city at random while the automatic clock was registering a fare that might appall anyone except a bride and groom. As they passed the Navy Building, a little man was seen entering a conveyance.
"That's Admiral Hawksby," explained Roberts to his companion. "He's going home now after what he calls a hard day's work. He'll be the sorest man in Washington when he hears of my escape. But it serves him right, the arrogant old ass. He thinks he knows it all, and he doesn't know anything."
For 5 minutes after that, the man and the girl simply sat and admired each other. It was a real mutual admiration society, with only 2 members. Marie Johnson certainly looked attractive. Her coal-black hair, parted in the middle, contrasted with the coquettishness of her face, and her dark gray eyes sparkled in the half-gloom of the cab. Percival complacently stroked his mustache and, leaning toward her, said tenderly,
I'll mark this day down as the luckiest day of my life, the day you ensured my happiness, and if I only thought you fully reciprocated my feelings.
I do, she interrupted. I do, and as soon as I can get one, I'm going to put a red mark around the date on the calendar.
They both laughed at this conceit, and after that there was a blissful silence. It was broken by the voice of the girl, speaking seriously and with a certain pathos.
You've been very frank with me, Percival. There is something I should like to tell you.
He interrupted her with a loyalty that astonished even himself. He had not thought he was capable of such high flights.
Never mind about your past, Marie. I don't want to hear a word.
Oh, it isn't anything terrible,
she retorted with feminine inconsistency.
I simply wanted you to know that before I came to this city, I was an actress. Do you mind?
Roberts laughed heartily.
Mind? Well, I should say not. I should say it was a sort of distinction, and I'll bet my bottom dollar you were a mighty clever actress.
Well,
she said reflectively,
I know I wasn't dismissed for incompetence.
By this time the outlines of the Union Station began to loom in sight. Percival looked ahead and prepared to alight as soon as the cab drove up to the curb. On and on they went until they were within a block of their destination. The spy uttered an exclamation of impatience and called out to the driver.
Hey, out there, didn't I tell you to stop before we got to the station?
But the taxi went right ahead as though nothing had been said. The young man half arose in his seat. Marie turned to him with a look of alarm.
What's the trouble? You mustn't do that while the machine is in motion.
Roberts fell back into his seat with a muttered oath.
It's that infernal driver. He's so stupid that he doesn't know enough to do as I tell him.
Well, I guess we'll have to go into the station after all.
But strangely enough, the taxicab did not go into the regular driveway of the station. Instead, it circled around the building and paused in front of the entrance to a small room. The driver jumped from his seat and opened the door. Percival Roberts alighted first and then assisted Marie to the ground. He turned to give the driver a piece of his mind for his stupidity, but that personage, with unlooked-for insolence, gave him a push and sent him into the little room. Percival was furious, and he doubled up his fist menacingly. As he did so, he noticed a figure in the half-darkened room. It gave him a start, and no wonder, for it was Admiral Hawksby, stroking his mustache and imperial and with deep satisfaction depicted on his grizzled face. Roberts was scared, but he kept his self-possession. The presence of the old sea fighter might be merely a coincidence. He turned around to the driver of the taxicab, and as he did so, the stupid one tossed away his glazed cap and took off his green goggles. The spy looked at the other man with half-dazed fury. He was staring into the face of Bromley Barnes, special investigator of the United States government. Bewilderment filled his mind. Then gradually he rallied. He looked around the room. The admiral and the detective were looking at him curiously. Presently his eyes fell upon Marie Johnson. She stood by a table in the center of the room, and she seemed to be trembling like a leaf. Her head was buried in the folds of her coat, and her breast heaved convulsively. He remembered that the incriminating papers were in the inside pocket of her coat. In that instant, his resolution was formed.
"Well, gentlemen,"
he said, fingering the pink carnation in his coat, and with that nonchalant smile which he could assume so quickly.
"What is the meaning of this?"
Barnes grinned at him amiably.
"We wanted to be sociable. We couldn't bear to see you go off without saying goodbye. We've already got Lee Holman and the code man."
Roberts smiled in return, but his brain was working furiously. He looked again in the direction of Marie. She seemed to be trying to control her emotions. At any moment she might break down. He must anticipate anything she might say. In those seconds of thought, any affection he might have felt for her vanished into thin air. He felt a new emotion, and yet it was not new. It was as old as the everlasting hills. It was the impulse of self-preservation. He was willing to sacrifice anything and anyone to save himself. He moistened his lips with the tip of his tongue, and steadying himself, said slowly,
"Well,
gentlemen, you've anticipated me a little bit, but still I think I can claim credit for helping my country."
The detective looked at him in a puzzled way. When he spoke, it was brusquely.
"What in thunder are you talking about?"
In reply to his question, Percival pointed an accusing finger in the direction of Marie.
"Simply this. I have arrested that woman as a spy, and I now desire to transfer her to your custody. I still have some evidence to get, but I will appear against her in the morning."
The woman, who had been standing, sank into a chair as if in total collapse. She buried her face in her hands and refused to look up. Bromley Barnes gazed at the man with a curious smile hovering about his lips. He spoke in a voice of authority.
"Young man, it is one thing to accuse and another to prove. Where is the proof of what you say?"
Percival Roberts took a turn up and down the room before replying. He was considering the dramatic effect of what he was about to say. Then he pointed his hand at the girl for the second time and exclaimed loudly,
"Search her and you will find a number of messages that have been intercepted from the Navy Department. They are in the inside pocket of her coat. I saw her put them there, and I am willing to so testify in a court of law."
Something like a sob was heard to come from the woman with the bowed head, and then the murmur in a muffled voice.
"Oh, Percival, how could you?"
Several speechless seconds passed. A dramatic tableau was being enacted in the little room. Admiral Hawksby broke the silence with one brusque sentence.
"Well, Barnes, why don't you search the woman?"
The cold gray eyes of the investigator softened just a little bit, and the quizzical smile became more pronounced, but he went over to Marie and commanded her to rise. She did so, and he unbuttoned her coat and took out the packet of letters from the inside pocket. As he read them, his eyes widened and he emitted a low, significant whistle.
"Are these all of the papers?"
he asked the girl.
"Yes,"
was the reply with downcast eyes.
"All that I know anything about."
Percival Roberts had been watching her intently, and her manner seemed to reassure him, for turning to Barnes, he exclaimed,
"You see, I've told the truth, and now, if you'll excuse me for the present, I'll appear at your office the first thing in the morning."
Barnes looked at him with a sort of contempt, and then, producing a whistle, blew it softly. Two officers rushed into the room, and the next thing Roberts knew, he was on the floor of the patrol wagon. He managed to regain his feet just as the admiral, the detective, and the girl came out of the railroad station. He turned to one of the officers and pointed in the direction of the trio.
"Who?" he spluttered. "Who is that woman going down the street?"
The policeman shaded his eyes with one hand in order to get a better view of the girl, and then replied in the most matter-of-fact way,
"That's Miss Johnson, the smartest little woman in the United States Secret Service.